Succession, number 30059, Reel 5.
That we're talking about now. And Julio called me right away and he said, Kelsey wasn't in command of the outfit, you were in command of the outfit. I said, you forgot a conversation we had one day where you said it was going to be a joint command, and I said, it didn't make a difference who was in command, the job would get finished, something like that. He said, did I? And I said, yes, you did, Jim. And he said, well, then, is it safe to say then the statement they made in here that he commanded the other? I said, yes, perfectly safe, because he did. It's perfectly safe to say that I did, too, because it was a joint command, really. So in the foreword, he doesn't mention the foreword, but he says what a fine officer Ben was and how his insight and so on, it was a really fine foreword. So I guess on paper then I became the commanding officer when Ben returned to the States. Well, actually I was the commanding officer before that. I mean, on paper even, because Ben was taken off of, I don't remember exactly when, but it was, I went back to the States in November, or late November of 44, to transition into P-80s, and I was to get the first P-80 group for operational purposes when I came to the UK, which was scheduled for January of 45. And I spent a month at Lockheed and up at Muroc Dry Lake, where now what do they call it, for the shuttle land, Edwards Air Force. I spent a month between the two places, flying first the P-59, which was the Bell twin jet, and then the YP-80, and then finally the P-80 itself. Ben was in the States then. When I got back, I saw Ben in Wright Field, at Wright Field on my way back to the UK, just 2 or 3 days before the Battle of the Bulge. I know it's close on to Christmas, 2 or 3 days. And he was back in the States permanently at that time. I think Al Key had been left in temporary command of the outfit when Ben left. I think people were reporting to Al Link. I think he was a senior. No, Jack Taylor. I don't remember. You know, this was a very informal outfit. I'm sure we had a table of organization of sorts, but it changed every day, literally. And the personnel changed often, and the duty assignments changed because people were flexible and they had the abilities that let them do other jobs. So I don't know how to answer that question directly. Did the JSF become CO? Well, I think I did have information, so Roger can decide what he wants to say. When was the Air Technical Section of 8th Fighter Command so named? Well, I'd say that it was very soon after I came to Fighter Command headquarters on a permanent basis, which was late 42, I mean maybe December 42, after the North African dip. Mm-hmm. Yes, because I was in the hospital in Oxford in the Christmas time of 42, and until about the 1st of February of 43. And it was during that time that the name was changed. Mm-hmm. I can't put a finger on the date, but that's close enough. Mm-hmm. The exact date, I'd have to, let's say it was let's say it was December 15th, 1942. It's very close to that.
Okay.
What date did the 8th Technical Operations become the new name for operational engineering? Well, 8th Technical Operations was a unit of 8th Air Force headquarters rather than 8th Fighter Command, whereas the technical section in section in question 6
mm-hmm.
was a unit of 8th Fighter Command.
Okay.
So when the 8th Technical Operations, when Doolittle was told he couldn't name the section Operational Engineering,
mm-hmm.
he asked me what I wanted to name it. I don't care what to name it. We're going to do some operational flying. We're going to be very closely, very part of the operational effort. And if you want, let's call it technical operations then. The technical side of operations, Doolittle agreed. And that's how it did. And it said, this time was the state of the chain of command chain. At this time was the state of, well, that was when it became part of 8th Air Force rather than an 8th Fighter Command. He lifted the whole outfit right out of 8th Fighter Command. So he picked the people that I wanted and then said, you have the whole 8th Air Force to pick from and people. And that's when he gave me a long lecture on what he wanted me to do. And at that time I had done only on a try to help out basis with the bombardment problems because I was part of Fighter Command and 8th Air Force Service Command was presumably doing the work for Bomber Command, but they weren't doing it. And people used to come to me personally and say, will you help me with this or help me with that? We've got this kind of a problem. And I would try to help them, but I got my tip in the ringer two or three times that way by being quoted to Jack Griffiths by people in Bomber Command. Cass Huff said so-and-so and so-and-so, and once Jack Griffiths had reputed to him, said, I don't care what that son of a bitch said, this is the way it's going to be. Oh, it was a brilliant dog. It was too bad because we could have together, if Jack Griffiths had realized that we weren't in any way impinging on his or impugning his ability to handle things, that we were just another element in trying to win the war. But, you know what?
A man of jealousy?
I don't know what it was. He was regular Army, and I came up, you know, from nothing, and I don't know what it was. I mean, the idea didn't really make much difference. So.
Back up to question 6. At the end of it, it says, you were chief of flight research and engineer, and then in April 43 as chief technical section. Is that correct? As you recall?
Is it a fact?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is that
I guess so. He's gone into the records, and I didn't.
Well, there were question marks after it, and I wondered if there was any question in your mind whether that was. So.
We see that General Hunter, I don't know, but my guess is, I know that's right. General Hunter said, we've got to change the name because Service Command are upset with that name, Flight Research and Engineering. If there's any flight research and engineering to be done, it's going to be done by Service Command. And so he said, I'm going to call it Technical Section. He said, that's broad enough, isn't it? And I said, again, I could care less what you call it. And
okay.
Griffiths, again, had his fine jacket, had his fine hand in that one, I'm sure. But they must have supported the states because the states were bitterly opposed to anybody in the field doing anything.
They've never gotten out of the hedgerows in Normandy if they
That's right.
acted that way on the ground.
wouldn't have got to the end of the hedge row. I'm sure of that. I like Jack Richardson as a person. He was a personable guy, but he just had a mania about this thing. So he was, or at least service commander, the one that was responsible for making General Hunter change the name from Flight Research and Engineering. And there again, they said, well, look, I have Pozlowski and Schaefer and Wack and a couple of mechanics out at Bobbing and a couple of airplanes. I had a P-38 and I had a P-47. And the service command said, let us have the whole outfit, the people and the whole outfit, and we'll let them continue just what they're doing. And General Hunter said, no way, I'm going to keep them right here. Because I promised Cass up a group, and he's going to get that group. In the meantime, he's going to do this work for me until I get ready to give him the group. So the exact date for air technical section would have to be, as I said before, make it the 15th of December or somewhere, just before the turn of the year anyway.
Okay.
And I think I've answered what date technical operations become a new name.
Yeah.
And this change of status or chain of command.
Right.
What was maintenance and technical services? Maintenance and technical services was a name that someone in Doolittle's headquarters, when Doolittle was away, decided that the name for Doolittle had named it operational engineering. Doolittle was away when orders came from the states that it couldn't be operational engineering unless it was part of the service command. And whoever, whether it was Jack Allard, who was chief of staff for Doolittle, or who it was, I don't know, just took the teletype and then put a new name on the TO, and for lack of better, called it maintenance and technical services. And when Doolittle got back, he blew his stack about that one. And he said, we're not a service, this is not a service or maintenance outfit, this is an engineering outfit, and so on. And he called me and said, what are we going to call it? And they would call it technical operations. He said, you got away with it. The fighter command headquarters, calling it air tech operations, call it 8th Air Force Technical Operations. He said, that's fine. And that's, that would have to be somebody in 8th Air Force headquarters persisted in passing projects that are still under maintenance technical service. Whether they had looked at the old TO or what, I don't know.
Was it part of, it was not part of 8th Air Force Service Command?
No.
Definitely not.
And it wasn't part of USAF?
No. It was just 8th Air Force. By that time.
MTS was our option. Still a part of 8th Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't during the final months of the war. Final months of the war, everything referred to technical operations.
You think that the fact that there are references to MTS is just a name confusion?
Just a name, yes. The same outfit. And people just... I'm sure someone in 8th Air Force headquarters just simply, for the while that it was in maintenance and technical services, have been passing projects to us, particularly correspondence from RAF headquarters. Kathy came through to a little, we had a lot of direct communications too. They probably just put MTS on there. MTS.
I don't think that's Gene trying to ring through, do you? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
I made them stop. They were answering on about the third ring, the answering service was.
You could argue
that. A lot of my friends calling from, you know, across the country someplace and were getting the answering service after they probably had a chance to stop ringing. So I made them. I said, you wait till it's rung about eight times before you answer.
Right. Okay, so all of this is really a name.
It is, all goes back to that original that for service command just refused to, consistently refused to let even General Doolittle do what he wanted to do with the name, for example. Doolittle never stopped calling it operational engineering. Never referred to it as anything but operational engineering. I've got correspondence from him calling it operational engineering when there wasn't any operational engineering.
Mm-hmm.
But MTS was a name that somebody in 8th Air Force Headquarters gave to it, and I squawked about it because we weren't a maintenance outfit for anything. It had nothing to do with maintenance. And when Doolittle came back and saw it, he had a fit too. That's a lousy answer, that question number 8. But
no, I don't think that's a bad answer. I think that it's hard to explain name confusions when it's in an argument.
Is there any paper that says clearly the chain of command affecting operational engineering? Here we go again.
See, yeah, here we go.
What was the official link between operational engineering and 8th Air Force? None. A stone wall.
That's why there's a fog.
Did Don Ostrander transfer from 8th Fighter Command to operational? It wasn't in the operational engineering section. No, he was on TEY from 8th Fighter Command. For quite a period of time, he turned over all of his armament responsibilities to whoever his deputy was after him, and spent all his time with us when we were working on the groups so that was getting out of
here. Yes.
How was the name Drupsnoot derived? I think that group named Drupsnoot, as near as I can remember, came when I was up at Langford Lodge with some final work done on the Drupsnoot. Over a couple of drinks one night, somebody's, I don't know who it was, someone with a group up there at Langford Lodge said, when are you going to fly that droopy snooted thing or something like that operationally? And I thought it was a pretty good name. Everybody referred to the droop snoot from then on. There's no, we took the, we took the guns and everything out of it, and it did have a funny look in front, but it had no particular pilots in it. As he asks in here, there was a meeting, but just a droopy look to the nose that when you took the guns out of there, it gave it a funny look. That's
yeah, I don't think there is any double entendre even.
No, there isn't any, no.
None. just...
I remember that from that point on, when it was in the process of being finalized, that the work that I couldn't do everything at Bobbington.
Mm-hmm.
I did most of the work at Bobbington, but some of the planner things in structure and sort of thing, we just didn't have the facilities. So I flew the airplane up to Langford Lodge and left it there. And they did the work that I wanted done. So they had a fine shop up there.
Did they put the actual nose on the thing at
Langford? We did all the preliminary work. We took the guns out of the nose and figured out where the northern sight should go, figured out there was room enough in there for lying down or sitting up like this if you wanted to, navigator bombardier, and room to put an oxygen supply, and we did all those things in bombing them. And then I just took the rough work and took it up the length of margin and finished the job for me up there.
While we're on that, I'll jump in. Sorry, Roger. How did the navigator get out?
Well, there
in
was
an
a,
emergency.
There was a there was somebody that was pretty good at squirming through small holes, particularly with the parachute and the dinghy. There was a hatch cover on the port side of the Nome that had two wing nuts. Held it in like four, maybe, I don't remember.
It was on the side.
Well, it was on the
bottom side.
It was on the just halfway around from the top around to here, right about located about in here.
Okay.
And he couldn't get out without somebody opening from the outside.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding. No,
that was always that way.
Always, there was no way for him to get out.
So no one could ever bail out.
So just bother anybody.
Why would they wear a parachute?
Well, because the regulations require that any man getting in a military airplane wear a parachute and a dinghy.
So that anyone flying with someone in the Dukesnook and having engine trouble would have to bring it down, otherwise he would just be leaving.
Sure. I flew the first missions with it, and I used to say to Ostrander, look, you son of a bitch, you get these bombs on the target with this thing, or I'm going to jump on and leave you.
They never changed that.
Well, never changed it.
Good Lord. That answers one of my questions. Thank you. Okay. Let's see.
Exactly the Cezanne rooms.
Oh, yes, Cezanne.
Exactly. I have to look on my pictures, and I'm not sure I can lay my hands on them. I mean, I'll put for want of a better date at the moment, so I can, I'll have to dig about. It was about D plus 30. Roughly, which would make it the middle of July sometime, 44. Because the guns that were mounted on the casemates and Cezanne were controlling the entrance to the harbor at Cherbourg. And they could not get any large supply ships in there, and they needed them badly to support the troops of the Carentan Peninsula, the Cherbourg Peninsula. And that was the reason that the 8th Air Force had tried desperately to destroy that. But the pictures I've got have showed, I don't know how many times they bombed it, and it was just bounced around with dig a hole, maybe X feet deep. But this was solid rock.
And it was outside Cherbourg, not St. Malo.
Well, it was between the two.
Oh, okay.
And the way as I was told at the time, I never examined it carefully, but as I was told at the time, the only approach that the deep draft ships had to get supplies into Cherbourg. Something about it. So he called me one day and he said, you've got to do something, figure out some way we can can get rid of that annoyance at Saddam. He said, until those guns are silenced there, right now, so I suppose eventually, by keeping supplies from reaching them, eventually the thing will deteriorate so that it won't. But right now, we got to have a solution. Mm-hmm. So Ben and I took out one day. I led the thing, and Ben said, we'll look this thing over together. And he said, now, you know, there's a lot of German airplanes around, a lot of German fighters around. He said, I'll tell you what I'll do. You go down and have a look, and I'll cover you. And then if you get any ideas or don't get any ideas, then you come up and cover me, and I'll have a look. So I was first down, and I didn't see any way we could possibly do anything about it. I saw these craters that had been in, but we looked right in these casemates. We came up from the water, looked in the casemates, and you could see the gun muzzles. They're all around, just like the whole storm, controlling this whole thing. Ben couldn't see anything, so except you, I said, I'd like to make one more pass. So I was so mad by this time that it frustrated me. I got down in the water and came on up, looking right in the casemate, and fired all my guns right into the casemate. And 3 seconds, whoop, inside the casemate. And when the time I got up to altitude again, the Germans were running out of we got several places to get in and out, waving white flags. And Ben and I went down and circled around and keep our heads down. And we had lots of fuel, fortunately. So we took turns flying around, keeping them, you know, right at their level to make sure they stood there practically at attention. And they were, too. They were only for a short burst over their heads. But then I'd go up and cover Ben. In the meantime, we had been patched through about 4 different military field switchboards, Army field switchboards. Finally, they got to the Navy and told the Navy they'd have to come take these prisoners. We claimed that the 8th Air Force claimed the island as captured by Kelsey and Huff, but that we had no means at our disposal to take off the prisoners. And would they help us? And so, in about an hour's time, they sent me around and around and down, going down, and a few well-placed shots, not necessarily right over their head, but close enough that they knew we were in earnest. The Navy put off a couple of boats, and we kept them to make sure the Navy was covered.
Yeah.
I stayed back on a low level there and just circled right around while the Navy team came up and took the prisoners off. They got their landing party ashore.
Mm-hmm.
That was the season.
I love that story. Has anybody ever written that up?
Oh, I'd like to. So many things I'd like to do. And when I plan my time now to do this sort of thing, then get my business back doesn't give me time to do anything except think about the business, and that is kind of stupid in a way. But my family want an autobiography, they want a family history, they want a friend of mine in aviation, want an aviation biography, or an autobiography, and I don't have the time to do it.
And there you are.
Yeah, I am. Robert Schaefer commissioned soon after Castoff brought him to Bollinger. Bob Schaefer was in the first fighter group with me.
Mm-hmm.
And actually he wasn't, he was in the 6th Wing, 6th Pursuit, then called 6th Pursuit Wing, which became the cadre for 8th Fighter Command headquarters. And he was tech sector. And I got him commissioned direct. At the time that after I got out of the hospital, it was in February of 43. So that was soon after I bought the body. How many hangers did Operation Engineer technically?